your cruelty. But I'll fight this self-destructive streak of yours with everything I have, so don't you talk about dropping out of school.
But I'll really do it, he answered. I don't want you to even kid yourself into thinking I won't. I'll be 18 in February, and I'll do it on my own then, if you don't stay out of this from now on. Do you understand me?
Go to bed, she said tearfully. Go to bed, you're breaking my heart.
Am I? Shockingly, he laughed. Hurts, doesn't it? I know.
He left then, walking slowly, the limp pulling his body slightly to the left. Shortly she heard the heavy, tired clump of his shoes on the stairs. Also a sound terribly reminiscent of her childhood, when she had thought to herself, "The ogre's going to bed." She burst into a fresh spasm of weeping, got up clumsily, and went out the back door to do her crying in private. She held herself, thin comfort but better than none, and looked up at a horned moon that was quadrupled through the film of her tears. Everything had changed, and it had happened with the speed of a cyclone. Her son hated her. She had seen it in his face. It wasn't a tantrum, a temporary peak, a passing squall of adolescence. He hated her, and this wasn't the way it was supposed to go with her good boy. Not at all. Not at all. She stood on the stoop and cried until the tears began to run their course, and the sobs became occasional hitchings and gasps. The cold gnawed her bare ankles above her mules and bit more bluntly through her housecoat. She went inside and upstairs. She stood outside Arnie's room indecisively for almost a minute before going in. He had fallen asleep on the coverlet of his bed. His pants were still on. He seemed more unconscious than asleep, and his face looked horribly old. A trick of the light, coming from the hall and falling into the room from over her shoulder, made it seem for a moment to her that his hair was thinning, that his sleep-gaping mouth was without teeth. A small squeal of horror strained itself through the hand clapped to her mouth, and she hurried toward him. Her shadow, which had been on the bed, moved with her, and she saw it was only Arnie, the impression of age no more than the light and her own exhausted confusion. She looked at his clock radio and saw that it was set for 4:30 a.m. She thought of turning the alarm off. She even stretched her hand out to do it. Ultimately, she found she couldn't. Instead, she went down to her bedroom, sat down at the phone table, and picked up the handset. She held it for a moment, debating. If she called Mike in the middle of the night, he would think that something terrible had happened. She giggled. Well, hadn't it? It surely had. And it was still happening. She dialed the number of the Ramada Inn in Kansas City, where her husband was staying, vaguely aware that she was, for the first time since she had left the grim and grimy three-story house in Roxburg for college 27 years before, calling for help. Chapter 28. Lee Makes a Visit. She got through most of the story okay, sitting in one of the two visitors' chairs with her knees pressed firmly together and her ankles crossed, neatly dressed in a multicolored wool sweater and a brown corduroy skirt. It was not until the end that she began to cry, and she couldn't find a handkerchief. Dennis Gilder handed her the box of tissues from the table beside the bed. "Take it easy, Lee," he said.
I can. He hasn't been to see me. And in school he just seems so tired. And you said he hasn't been here.
He'll come if he needs me, Dennis said.
You're full of macho bullshit, she said,
and then looked comically stunned at what she had said. The tears had cut tracks in the light makeup she was wearing. She and Dennis looked at each other for a moment, and then they laughed. But it was brief laughter. And not really that good.
Has Motormouth seen him? Dennis asked.
Who?
Motormouth. That's what Larry Baron calls Mr. Vickers, the guidance counselor?
Oh, yes. I think he has. He was called to their guidance office the day before yesterday, Monday. But he didn't say anything, and I didn't dare ask him anything. He won't talk. He's gotten so strange.
Dennis nodded, although he didn't think Lee realized it. She was deep in her own trouble and confusion. He felt a sense of impotence and a deepening fear for Arnie. From the reports that had filtered into his room over the last few days, Arnie sounded on the verge of a nervous breakdown. Lee's report was only the most recent and the most graphic. He had never wanted to be out as badly as he did now. Of course, he could call Vickers and ask him if there was anything he could do, and he could call Arnie. Except from what Lee had said, Arnie was now always at school, at Darnell's, or sleeping. His father had come home early from some sort of convention, and there had been another fight, Lee had told him. Although Arnie had not come right out and said so, Lee told Dennis she believed that he had come very close to simply leaving home. Dennis didn't want to talk to Arnie at Darnell's.
"What can I do?" she asked him. "What would you do in my place?"
"Wait," Dennis said. "I don't know what else you can do."
"But that's hardest,"
she answered, in a voice so low it was almost inaudible. Her hands were clenching and unclenching on the Kleenex, shredding it, dotting her brown skirt with speckles of lint.
"My folks want me to stop seeing him, to drop him. They're afraid that Repperton and those other boys will do something else."
"You're pretty sure it was Buddy and his friends, huh?"
"Yes, everybody is. Mr. Cunningham called the police, even though Arnie told him not to. He said he'd settle the score in his own way, and that scared them both. It scares me, too." "The police picked up Buddy Repperton, and one of his friends, the one they called Moochie, do you know who I mean?"
"Yes."
"And the boy who works nights at the airport parking lot. They picked him up, too. Galton, his name is?"
"Sandy."
"They thought he must have been in on it, that maybe he let them in."
"He runs with them, all right," Dennis said. "But he's not quite as degenerate as the rest of them. I'll say this, Lee. If Arnie didn't talk to you, someone sure did."
"First Mrs. Cunningham and then his father. I don't think either of them knew the other one had talked to me. They're..."
"Upset," Dennis suggested. She shook her head.
"It's more than that," she said. "They both look like they were just mugged or something. I can't really feel sorry for her. All she wants is her own way, I think. But I could cry for Mr. Cunningham. He just seems so...
She trailed off and then began again.
"When I got there yesterday afternoon, after school, Mrs. Cunningham... She asked me to call her Regina, but I just can't seem to do it."
Dennis grinned.
"Can you do it?"
Lee asked. "Well, yeah, but I've had a lot more practice." She smiled, the first good one of her visit.
"Maybe that would make a difference. Anyway, when I went over, she was there, but Mr. Cunningham was still at school. The university, I mean."
"Yeah."
"She took the whole week off, what there is of it. She said she couldn't go back, even for the 3 days before Thanksgiving."
"How does she look?"
"She looked shattered," Lee said, and reached for a fresh Kleenex. She began shredding the edges. "She looks 10 years older than when I first met her a month ago."
"And him, Michael?"
"Older, but tougher," Lee said hesitantly, as if this had somehow gotten him into gear.
Dennis was silent. He had known Michael Cunningham for 13 years and had never seen him in gear, so he wouldn't know. Regina had always been the one in gear. Michael trailed along in her wake and made the drinks at the parties, mostly faculty parties, the Cunninghams hosted. He played his recorder. He looked melancholy. But by no stretch of the imagination could Dennis say he had ever seen the man in gear. The final triumph, Dennis's father had said once, standing at the window and watching Regina lead Arnie by the hand down the Gilder's Walk to where Michael waited behind the wheel of the car. Arnie and Dennis had been perhaps 7 then. Momism supreme. I wonder if she'll make the poor slob wait in the car when Arnie gets married. Or maybe she can... Dennis's mother had frowned at her husband and shushed him by cutting her eyes at Dennis in a little pitchers have big ears gesture. He never forgot the gesture or what his father had said. At 7, he hadn't understood all of it, but even at 7, he knew perfectly well what a poor slob was. And even at 7, he vaguely understood why his father might think Michael Cunningham was one. He had felt sad for Michael Cunningham, and that feeling had held off and on, right up to the present.
"He came in around the time she was finishing her story," Lee went on. "They asked me to stay for supper. Arnie has been eating down at Darnell's, but I told him I really had to get back. So Mr. Cunningham offered me a ride, and I got his side on the way home."
"Are they on different sides?"
"Not exactly, but Mr. Cunningham was the one who went to see the police, for instance. Arnie didn't want to, and Mrs. Cunningham, Regina, couldn't bring herself to do it."
Dennis asked cautiously, "He's really trying to put Humpty back together again, huh?"
"Yes,"
she whispered, and then burst out shrilly.
"But that's not all. He's in deep with that guy, Darnell. I know he is. Yesterday in Period 3 study hall, he told me he was going to drop a new front end into his car this afternoon and this evening, and I said, 'Won't that be awfully expensive, Arnie?' And he said not to worry about it because his credit was good."
"Slow down." She was crying again.
"His credit was good because he and someone named Jimmy Sykes were going to do some errands for Will Friday and Saturday. That's what he said, and I don't think the errands he does for that son of a bitch are legal."
"What did he tell the police when they came to ask about Christine?"
"He told them about finding it that way. They asked him if he had any ideas who might have done it, and Arnie said no. They asked him if it wasn't true that he had gotten into a fight with Buddy Repperton, that Repperton had pulled a knife and had been expelled for it. Arnie said that Repperton had knocked his bag lunch out of his hand and stepped on it. Then Mr. Casey came over from the shop and broke it up. They asked him if Repperton hadn't said he would get him for it, and Arnie said he might have said something like that, but talk was cheap."
Dennis was silent, looking out his window at a dull November sky, considering this. He found it ominous. If Lee had the interview with the police right, then Arnie hadn't told a single lie. But he had edited things to make what had happened in the smoking area sound like your ordinary pushy-pushy. Dennis found that extremely ominous.
"Do you know what Arnie might be doing for that man, Darnell?" Lee asked.
"No," Dennis answered, but he had some ideas. A little internal tape recorder started up, and he heard his father saying, "I've heard a few things. Stolen cars, cigarettes and booze, contraband-like fireworks. He's been lucky for a long time, Dennis." He looked at Lee's face, too pale, her makeup cut open by her tears. She was hanging on to Arnie as best she could. Maybe she was learning something about being tough that she wouldn't have learned otherwise with her looks for another 10 years. But that didn't make it any easier, and it didn't necessarily make it right. It occurred to him suddenly, almost randomly, that he had first noticed the improvement in Arnie's face more than a month before Arnie and Lee clicked, but after Arnie and Christine had clicked. "I'll talk to him," he promised.
"Good,"
she said. She stood up.
I don't want things to be like they were before, Dennis. I know nothing ever is, but I still love him, and I just wish you'd tell him that."
"Yeah, okay." They were both embarrassed, and neither of them could say anything for a long, long moment. Dennis was thinking that this would be the point in a C&W song where the best friend steps in. and a sneaking, mean, and randy part of him wouldn't be averse to that. Not at all. He was still powerfully attracted to her, more attracted than he had been to any girl in a long time. Maybe ever. Let Arnie run bottle rockets and cherry bombs over to Burlington and fuck around with his car. He and Lee could get to know each other better in the meantime. A little aid and comfort, you know how it is. And he had a feeling at just that awkward moment, after her profession of love for Arnie, that he could do it. She was vulnerable. She was maybe learning how to be tough, but it's not a school anyone goes to willingly. He could say something, the right something, maybe only, come here. And she would come, sit on the edge of the bed. They would talk some more, maybe about pleasanter things, and maybe he would kiss her. Her mouth was lovely and full, sensual, made to kiss and be kissed. Once for comfort, twice out of friendship, and three times pays for all. Yes, he felt with an instinct that had so far been quite reliable that it could be done. But he didn't say any of the things that could have started those things happening, and neither did Lee. Arnie was between them, and almost surely always would be. Arnie and his lady. If it hadn't been so ludicrously ghastly, he could have laughed.
"When are they letting you out?" she asked.
"On an unsuspecting public?" he asked, and began to giggle. After a moment, she joined him in his laughter.
"Yes, something like that," Lee said, and then snickered again. "Sorry."
"Don't be," Dennis said. "People have been laughing at me all my life. I'm used to it. They say I'm stuck here until January, but I'm going to fool them. I'm going home for Christmas. I'm working my buns off down in the torture chamber."
"Torture chamber?"
"Physical therapy. My back's looking good. The other bones are knitting busily. The itch is terrible sometimes. I'm gobbling rose hips by the bushel basket. Dr. Arroway says that's nothing but a folk tale, but Coach Puffer swears by them, and he checks the bottle every time he comes to visit."
"Does he come often, the coach?"
"Yeah, he does. Now he's got me half believing that stuff about rose hips making your broken bones knit faster." Dennis paused. "Of course, I'm not going to be playing any more football. Not ever. I'm going to be on crutches for a while, and then, with luck, I'll graduate to a cane. Cheerful old Dr. Arroway tells me I'm going to limp for maybe a couple of years. Or maybe I'll always limp."
"I'm so sorry," she said in a low voice. "I'm sorry it had to happen to a nice guy like you, Dennis, but part of it's selfish. I just wonder if all the rest of this, all this horrible stuff with Arnie, if it would have happened if you'd been up and around."
"That's right," Dennis said, rolling his eyes dramatically. "Blame it on me."
But she didn't smile. "I started to worry about his sanity. Did you know that? That's the one thing I haven't told my folks or his folks, but I think his mother, that she might... I don't know what he said to her that night, after we found the car all smashed up, but I think they must have really put their claws into each other."
Dennis nodded.
"But it's all so mad. His parents offered to buy him a good used car to replace Christine, and he said no. Then Mr. Cunningham told me on the ride home that he offered to buy Arnie a new car to cash in some bonds he's held ever since 1955. Arnie said no. He couldn't just take a present like that. And Mr. Cunningham said he could understand that, and it didn't have to be a present, that Arnie could pay him back, that he'd even take interest if that was what Arnie wanted. Dennis, do you see what I'm saying?"
"Yeah," Dennis said. "It can't be just any car. It's got to be that car. Christine."
"But to me that seems obsessive. He's found one object and fixed on it. Isn't that what an obsession is? I'm scared, and sometimes I feel hateful. But it's not him I'm scared of. It's not him I hate. It's that frig... No, it's that fucking car. That bitch, Christine."
High color bloomed in her cheeks. Her eyes narrowed. The corners of her mouth turned down. Her face was suddenly no longer beautiful, not even pretty. The light on it was pitiless, changing it into something that was ugly, but all the same striking, compelling. Dennis realized for the first time why they called it the monster, the green-eyed monster.
"I'll tell you what I wish would happen," Lee said. "I wish somebody would take his precious fucking Christine out back some night, by mistake, out where they put the junks from Philly Plains."
Her eyes sparkled venomously.
"And the next day I wish that crane with the big round magnet would come and pick it up and put it in the crusher. And I wish someone would push the button, and what would come out would be a little cube of metal about 3 by 3 by 3. Then this would be over, wouldn't it?"
Dennis didn't answer. And after a moment he could almost see the monster turn around and wrap its scaly tail around itself and steal out of her face. Her shoulders sagged.
"Guess that sounds pretty horrible, doesn't it? Like saying I wish those hoods had finished the job."
"I understand how you feel."
"Do you?"
she challenged. Dennis thought of Arnie's look as he had pounded his fists on the dashboard, the kind of maniacal light that came into his eyes when he was around her. He thought of sitting behind the wheel in LeBay's garage and the kind of vision that had come over him. Last of all, he thought of his dream. Headlights bearing down on him in the high woman scream of burning rubber. "Yes," he said. "I think I do." They looked at each other in the hospital room. Chapter 29. Thanksgiving. At the hospital, they served Thanksgiving dinner in shifts from 11 in the morning until 1 in the afternoon. Dennis got his at 12:15, 3 careful slices of white turkey breast, 1 careful ladleful of brown gravy, a scoop of instant mashed potatoes the exact size and shape of a baseball, lacking only the red stitches, he thought with sour amusement, a like scoop of frozen squash that was an arrogant fluorescent orange, and a small plastic container of cranberry jelly. For dessert, there was ice cream. Resting on the corner of his tray was a small blue card. Wise to the ways of the hospital by now, once you have been treated for the first set of bed sores to crop up on your ass, Dennis had discovered, you're wiser to the ways of the hospital than you ever wanted to be. He asked the candy striper who came to take away his tray what the yellow and red cards got for their Thanksgiving dinner. It turned out that the yellow cards got 2 pieces of turkey, no gravy, potato, no squash, and jello for dessert. The red cards got 1 slice of white meat, pureed, and potato, fed to them, in most cases. Dennis found it all pretty depressing. It was only too easy to imagine his mother bringing a great, big, crackling capon to the dining room table around 4 in the afternoon, his father sharpening his carving knife, his sister, flushed with importance and excitement, a red velvet ribbon in her hair, pouring each of them a glass of good red wine. It was also easy to imagine the good smells, the laughter as they sat down. Easy to imagine, but probably a mistake. It was, in fact, the most depressing Thanksgiving of his life. He drifted off into an unaccustomed early afternoon nap, no physical therapy because of the holiday, and dreamed an unsettling dream in which several candy stripers walked through the IC ward and slapped turkey decals onto the life support machinery and IV drips. His mother, father, and sister had come over to visit for an hour in the morning, and for the first time he had sensed in Ellie an anxiousness to be gone. They had been invited over to the Callisons for a light Thanksgiving brunch, and Lou Callison, one of the 3 Callison boys, was 14 and cute. Her racked-up brother had become boring. They hadn't discovered a rare and tragic form of cancer breeding in his bones. He wasn't going to be paralyzed for the rest of his life. There was no movie of the week in him. They had called him from the Callisons around 12:30, and his father sounded a bit drunk. Dennis guessed he was maybe on his second Bloody Mary, and was maybe getting some disapproving looks from Mom. Dennis himself had just been finishing up his dietitian-approved, blue-carded Thanksgiving dinner, the only such dinner he had ever been able to finish in 15 minutes. And he did a good job of sounding cheerful, not wanting to spoil their good time. Ellie came on the wire briefly, sounding giggly and rather screaming. Maybe it was talking to Ellie that had tired him out enough to need a nap. He had fallen asleep and had his unsettling dream around 2 o'clock. The hospital was unusually quiet today, running on a skeleton staff. The usual babble of TVs and transistor radios from the other rooms was muted. The candy striper who took his tray smiled brightly and said she hoped that he had enjoyed his special dinner. Dennis assured her that he had. After all, it was Thanksgiving for her, too. And so he dreamed, and the dream broke up and became a darker sleep. And when he woke up, it was nearly 5 o'clock, and Arnie Cunningham was sitting on the hard plastic contour chair where his girl had sat only the day before. Dennis was not at all surprised to see him there. He simply assumed that it was a new dream. "Hi, Arnie," he said. "How's it hanging?"
"Hanging good," Arnie said. "But you look like you're still asleep, Dennis. Want some head nuggies? That'll wake you up."
There was a brown bag on his lap, and Dennis's sleepy mind thought, "Got his lunch after all. Maybe Repperton didn't squash it as bad as we thought." He tried to sit up in the bed, hurt his back, and used the control panel to get into what was almost a sitting position. The motor whined.
"Jesus, it's really you. Were you expecting Ghidra, the three-headed monster?"
Arnie asked amiably.
"I was sleeping. I guess I thought I still was."
Dennis rubbed his forehead hard, as if to get rid of the sleep behind it.
"Happy Thanksgiving, Arnie."
"You bet,"
Arnie said.
"Same to you. Did they feed you turkey with all the trimmings?"
Dennis laughed. "I got something that looked like those play dinners that came with Ellie's Happy Time cafeteria when she was about 7, remember?" Arnie put his cupped hands to his mouth and made ralphing noises.
"I remember. What a gross out."
"I'm really glad you came," Dennis said, and for a moment he was perilously close to tears. Maybe he hadn't realized just how depressed he had been. He redoubled his determination to be home by Christmas. If he was here on Christmas Day, he'd probably commit suicide.
"Your folks didn't come?"
"Sure they did," Dennis said. "And they'll be back again tonight. Mom and Dad will be anyway, but it's not the same. You know."
"Yeah. Well, I brought some stuff. Told the lady downstairs I had your bathrobe."
Arnie giggled a little.
"What is that?"
Dennis asked, nodding at the bag. It wasn't just a lunch bag, he saw. It was a shopping bag.
"I raided the fridge after we ate the bird," Arnie said.
"My mom and Dad went around visiting their friends from the university. They do that every year on Thanksgiving afternoon. They won't even be back until around 8. As he talked, he took things out of the bag. Dennis watched, amazed, 2 pewter candle holders, 2 candles. Arnie slammed the candles into the holders, lit them with a matchbook advertising Darnell's Garage, and turned off the overhead light. Then, 4 sandwiches, clumsily wrapped in waxed paper.
"The way I recall it," Arnie said, "you always said that scarfing up a couple of turkey sandwiches around 11:30 Thursday night was better than Thanksgiving dinner anyway, because the pressure was off."
"Yeah," Dennis said, "sandwiches in front of the TV, Carson or some old movie, but honest to God, Arnie, you didn't have to."
"Oh, shit. I haven't even been around to see you in almost 3 weeks. Good thing for me you were sleeping when I came in, or you probably would have shot me."
He tapped Dennis's 2 sandwiches.
"Your favorite, I think. White meat and mayo and Wonder Bread?"
Dennis got giggling at that, then laughing, then roaring. Arnie could see it hurt his back, but he couldn't stop. Wonder Bread had been one of Arnie and Dennis's great common secrets as children. Both of their mothers had been very serious about the subject of bread. Regina bought diet-thin loaves, with an occasional side trip into the land of stone-ground rye. Dennis's mother favored Roman meal and pumpernickel loaves. Arnie and Dennis ate what was given them. But both were secret Wonder Bread freaks. And on more than one occasion, they had pooled their money, and instead of buying sweets, they had gotten a loaf of Wonder and a jar of French's mustard. They would then slink out into Arnie's garage, or Dennis's treehouse, sadly demolished in a windstorm almost 9 years before, and gobble mustard sandwiches and read Richie Rich comic books until the whole loaf was gone. Arnie joined him in his laughter, and for Dennis, that was the best part of Thanksgiving. Dennis had been between roommates for almost 10 days, and so had the semi-private room to himself. Arnie closed the door and produced a six-pack of Busch beer from the brown bag. "Wonders will never cease," Dennis said, and had to laugh again at the unintentional pun.
"No," Arnie said. "I don't think they ever will."
He toasted Dennis over the candles with a bottle of beer.
"Prost."
"Live forever,"
Dennis responded. They drank. After they'd finished the thick turkey sandwiches, Arnie produced two plastic Tupperware pie wedges from his apparently bottomless bag and pried off the lids. Two pieces of homemade apple pie rested within.
"No, man, I can't," Dennis said. "I'll bust."
"Eat," Arnie commanded.
"I really can't,"
Dennis said, taking the Tupperware container and a fresh plastic fork. He finished the slice of pie in four huge bites and then belched. He upended the remainder of his second beer and belched again.
"In Portugal, that's a compliment to the cook," he said.
His head was buzzing pleasantly from the beer.
"Whatever you say,"
Arnie responded with a grin. He got up, turned on the overhead fluorescent, and snuffed the candles. Outside, a steady rain had begun to beat against the windows. It looked and sounded cold. And for Dennis, some of the warm spirit of friendship and real thanksgiving seemed to go out with the candles.
"I'm going to hate you tomorrow," Dennis said. "I'll probably have to sit on that John in there for an hour, and it hurts my back."
"You remember the time Elaine got the farts?"
Arnie asked, and they both laughed.
"We teased her until your mother gave us holy old hell."
"They didn't smell, but they sure were loud," Dennis said, smiling.
"Like gunshots," Arnie agreed,
and they both laughed a little. But it was a sad sort of laughter, if there is such a thing. A lot of water under the bridge. The thought that Ellie's attack of the farts had happened 7 years ago was somehow more unsettling than it was amusing. There was a breath of mortality in the realization that 7 years could steal past with such smooth and unobtrusive ease. Conversation lapsed a little, both of them lost in their own thoughts. At last, Dennis said,
"Lee came by yesterday. Told me about Christine. I'm sorry, man. Bummer."
Arnie looked up, and his expression of thoughtful melancholy was lost in a cheerful smile that Dennis didn't really believe.
"Yeah," he said, "it was screwed, but I went way overboard about it."
"Anybody would," Dennis said, aware that he had become suddenly watchful, hating it, but unable to help it. The friendship part was over. It had been here, warming the room and filling it, and now it had simply slipped away, like the ephemeral, delicate thing it was. Now, they were just dancing. Arnie's cheerful eyes were also opaque and, he would have sworn to it, watchful.
"Sure, I gave my mother a hard time. Lee, too, I guess. It was just the shock of seeing all that work. All that work down the tubes."
He shook his head.
"Bad news."
"Are you going to be able to do anything with it?"
Arnie brightened immediately. Really brightened this time, Dennis felt.
"Sure. I already have. You wouldn't believe it, Dennis. If you'd seen the way it looked in that parking lot, they made them tough in those days. Not like now, when all this stuff that looks like metal is really just shiny plastic. That car's nothing but a damn tank. The glass was the worst part, and the tires, of course. They slashed the tires."
"What about the engine?"
"Never got at it,"
Arnie said promptly. And that was the first lie. They had been at it, all right. When Arnie and Lee had gotten to Christine that afternoon, the distributor cap had been lying on the pavement. Lee had recognized it and had told Dennis about it. What else had they done under the hood, Dennis wondered. The radiator? If someone was going to use a tire iron to punch holes in the bodywork, might they not be apt to use the same tool to spring the radiator in a few places? What about the plugs, the voltage regulator, the carburetor?
"Arnie, why are you lying to me?" "So what are you doing with it now?" Dennis asked.
"Spending money on it, what else?"
Arnie said, and laughed his almost genuine laugh. Dennis might even have accepted it as genuine if he hadn't heard the real article once or twice over the Thanksgiving supper Arnie had brought.
"New tires, new glass, got some bodywork to do, and
Then it'll be as good as new.
As good as new. But Lee had said that they had found something that was little more than a smashed hulk, a carny three swings for a quarter derelict. Why are you lying?
For a cold moment, he found himself wondering if maybe Arnie hadn't gone a little crazy. But no, that wasn't the impression he gave. The feeling Dennis got from him was one of furtiveness, craftiness. Then, for the first time, the crazy thought came to him, the thought that maybe Arnie was only half lying, trying to lay a groundwork of plausibility for what? A case of spontaneous regeneration? That was pretty crazy, wasn't it?
Wasn't it?
It was indeed, Dennis thought, unless you had happened to see a mass of cracks in a windshield seem to shrink between one viewing and the next.
Just a trick of the light. That's what you thought then, and you were right.
But a trick of the light didn't explain the haphazard way Arnie had gone about rebuilding Christine, the hopscotch of old and new parts. It didn't explain that weird feeling Dennis had gotten sitting behind the wheel of Christine in LeBay's garage, or the sense, after the new tire had been put on en route to Darnell's, that he was looking at an old car picture with a new car picture directly underlying it, and that a hole had been cut out of the old car picture at that spot where one of the old car tires had been. And nothing explained Arnie's lie now, or the narrow, thoughtful way he was watching Dennis to see if his lie was going to be accepted. So he smiled, a big, easy, relieved grin. "Well, that's great," he said. Arnie's narrow, evaluating expression held for a moment longer. Then he smiled an aw-shucks grin and shrugged.
"Luck," he said, "when I think of the things they could have done... sugar in the gas tank, molasses in the car. They were stupid. Lucky for me."
"Repertoon and his merry crew?" Dennis asked quietly.
The suspicious look, so dark and unlike Arnie, appeared again, and then sank from sight. Arnie looked grim now, grim and morose. He seemed to speak, then sighed instead.
"Yeah," he said. "Who else?"
"But you didn't report it."
"My dad did."
"That's what Lee said."
"What else did she tell you?"
Arnie asked, sharply. "Nothing, and I didn't ask," Dennis said, holding his hand out. "Your business, Arnie. Peace."
"Sure."
He laughed a little, and then passed a hand over his face.
Still not over it. Fuck. I don't think I'm ever going to be over it, Dennis. Coming into that parking lot with Lee, feeling like I was on top of the world, and seeing...
"Won't they just do it again if you fix her up again?" Arnie's face went dead cold, set.
"They won't do it again," he said.
His gray eyes were like March ice, and Dennis found himself suddenly very glad he wasn't Buddy Repperton.
"What do you mean?"
"I'll be parking it at home, that's what I mean," he said,
and once more his face broke into that large, cheerful, unnatural grin.
"What'd you think I meant?"
"Nothing,"
Dennis said. The image of ice remained. Now it was a feeling of thin ice, creaking uneasily under his feet. Beneath that, black, cold water.
"But I don't know, Arnie. You seem awful sure that Buddy wants to let this go."
"I'm hoping he'll see it as a standoff," Arnie said quietly. "We got him expelled from school."
"He got himself expelled," Dennis said hotly. "He pulled a knife. Hell, it wasn't even a knife, it was a goddamn pig sticker."
"I'm just telling it the way he'll see it," Arnie said,
then held out his hand and laughed.
"Peace."
"Yeah. Okay.
We got him expelled, or more accurately, I did, and he and his buddies beat hell out of Christine. Evens. The end."
"Yeah, if he sees it that way."
"I think he will," Arnie said. "The cops questioned him, and Moochie Welch and Richie Trelawney. Scared them.
And almost got Sandy Galt to confess, I guess. Arnie's lip curled.
Fucking crybaby.
This was so unlike Arnie, the old Arnie, that Dennis sat up in bed without thinking and then winced at the pain in his back and lay down again quickly. Jesus, man. You sound like you want him to stonewall it.
I don't care what he or any of those shitters do, Arnie said,
and then in a strangely offhand voice he added, It doesn't matter anymore anyhow. Dennis said, Arnie, are you all right? And for a moment a look of desperate sadness passed over Arnie's face. More than sadness. He looked harried and haunted. It was the face, Dennis thought later. It is so easy to see these things later. Too much later. Of someone so bewildered and entangled and weary of struggling that he hardly knows anymore what it is he's doing. Then that expression, like that other look of dark suspicion, was gone.
Sure, he said. I'm great. Except that you're not the only one with a hurt back. You remember when I strained it at Philly Plains?
Dennis nodded.
Check this out.
He stood up and pulled his shirt out of his pants. Something seemed to dance in his eyes, something flipping and turning at a black depth. He lifted his shirt. It wasn't old-fashioned like LeBay's. It was cleaner, too. A neat, seemingly unbroken band of lycra about 12 inches across. But, Dennis thought, a brace was a brace. It was too close to LeBay for comfort.
I put another hurt on it getting Christine back to Will's, Arnie said. I don't even remember how I did it. That's how upset I was. Hooking her up to the wrecker, I guess. But I don't know for sure. At first it wasn't too bad. Then it got worse. Dr. Masha prescribed... Dennis, are you okay?
With what felt like a fantastic effort, Dennis kept his voice even. He moved his features around into an expression which felt at least faintly like pleasant interest. And still, there was that something dancing in Arnie's eyes. Dancing and dancing.
You'll shake it off, Dennis said.
Sure, I imagine,
Arnie said, tucking his shirt back in around the back brace.
I'm just supposed to watch what I lift, so I don't do it again.
He smiled at Dennis.
If there was still a draft, it'd keep me out of the army, he said.
Once again, Dennis restrained himself from any movement that could have been interpreted as surprise. But he put his arms under the bed's top sheet. At the sight of that back brace, so like LeBay's, they had broken out in goose flesh. Arnie's eyes, like black water under thin gray March ice, black water and glee dancing far down within them like the twisting, decomposing body of a drowned man.
Listen, Arnie said briskly, I gotta move. Hope you don't think I can hang around a lousy place like this all night.
That's you, always in demand, Dennis said. Seriously, man. Thanks. You cheered up a grim day. For one strange instant, he thought Arnie was going to weep. That dancing thing down deep in his eyes was gone, and his friend was there, really there. Then Arnie smiled sincerely.
Just remember one thing, Dennis. Nobody misses you. Nobody at all.
Eat me raw through a flavor straw, Dennis said solemnly. Arnie gave him the finger. The formalities were now complete. Arnie could leave. He gathered up his brown shopping bag, considerably deflated, candle holders and empty beer bottles clinking inside. Dennis had a sudden inspiration. He rapped his knuckles on his leg cast. Sign this, Arnie, would you?
I already did, didn't I?
Yeah, but it wore off. Sign it again?
Arnie shrugged. If you got a pen...
Dennis gave him one from the drawer of the night table. Grinning, Arnie bent over the cast, which was hoisted to an angle over the bed with a series of weights and pulleys, found white space in the intaglio of names and mottos, and scribbled, For Dennis Gilder, the world's biggest dork. Arnie Cunningham. He patted the cast when he was done and handed the pen back to Dennis.
Okay?
Yeah, Dennis said. Thanks. Stay loose, Arnie.
You know it. Happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you. Arnie left. Later on, Dennis's mother and father came in. Ellie, apparently exhausted by the day's hilarity, had gone home to bed. On their way home, the Gilders commented to each other on how withdrawn Dennis had seemed.
He was in a blue study, all right, Gilder said. Holidays in the hospital aren't any fun.
As for Dennis himself, he spent a long and thoughtful time that evening examining two signatures. Arnie had indeed signed his cast, but at a time when both of Dennis's legs had been in full leg casts. That first time, he had signed the cast on the right leg, which had been up in the air when Arnie came in. Tonight, he had signed the left. Dennis buzzed for a nurse and used all his charm, persuading her to lower his left leg so he could compare the two signatures side by side. The cast on his right leg had been cut down and would come off altogether in a week or 10 days. Arnie's signature had not rubbed off. That had been one of Dennis's lies. But it had very nearly been cut off. Arnie had not written a message on the right leg, only his signature. With some effort and some pain, Dennis and the nurse were able to maneuver his legs close enough together so he could study the two signatures side by side. In a voice so dry and cracked he was hardly able to recognize it as his own, he asked the nurse,
"Do they look the same to you?"
"No," the nurse said. "I've heard of forging checks, but never casts. Is it a joke?"
"Sure,"
Dennis said, feeling an icy coldness rise from his stomach to his chest.
"It's a joke."
He looked at the signatures. He looked at them side by side and felt that rising coldness steal all through him, lowering his body temperature, making the hairs on the back of his neck stir and stiffen. They were nothing alike. Late that Thanksgiving night, a cold wind rose, first gusting, then blowing steadily. The clear eye of the moon stared down from a black sky. The last brown and withered leaves of autumn were ripped from the trees and then harried through the gutters. They made a sound like rolling bones. Winter had come to Libertyville.
Chapter 30. Moochie Welch. The Thursday after Thanksgiving was the last day of November, the night that Jackson Browne played the Pittsburgh Civic Center to a sellout crowd. Moochie Welch went up with Richie Trelawney and Nicky Billingham, but got separated from them even before the show began. He was spare changing, and whether it was because the impending Brown concert had created some extremely mellow vibes, or because he was becoming something of an endearing feature, Moochie, a romantic, liked to believe the latter, he had had a remarkably good night. He had collected nearly $30 worth of spare change. It was distributed among all his pockets. Moochie jingled like a piggy bank. Thumbing home had been remarkably easy, too, with all the traffic leaving the Civic Center. The concert ended at 11:40, and he was back in Libertyville shortly after 1:15. His last ride was with a young guy who was headed back to Prestonville on Route 63. The guy dropped him at the 376 ramp on JFK Drive. Moochie decided to walk up to Vandenberg's Happy Gas and see Buddy. Buddy had a car, which meant that Moochie, who lived far out on Kingsfield Pike, wouldn't have to walk home. It was hard work hitching rides once you got out in the boonies, and the Kingsfield Pike was boondock city. It meant he wouldn't be home until well past dawn, but in cold weather a sure ride was not to be sneezed at, and Buddy might have a bottle. He had walked a quarter of a mile from the 376 exit ramp in the deep single-number cold, his cleated heels clicking on the deserted sidewalk, his shadow waxing and waning under the eerie orange street lamps, and he had still perhaps a mile to go when he saw the car parked at the curb up ahead. Exhaust curled out of its twin pipes and hung in the perfectly still air, clouding it, before drifting lazily away in stacked layers. The grill, bright chrome highlighted with pricks of orange light, looked at him like a grinning idiot mouth. Moochie recognized the car. It was a two-tone Plymouth. In the light of the maximum illumination street lamps, the two tones seemed to be ivory and dried blood.
It was Christine. Moochie stopped, and a stupid sort of wonder flooded through him. It was not fear, at least not at that moment. It couldn't be Christine. That was impossible. They had punched a dozen holes in the radiator of Cuntface's car. They had dumped a nearly full bottle of Texas Driver into the carb, and Buddy had produced a 5-pound sack of Domino sugar, which he had funneled into the gas tank through Moochie's cupped hands. And all of that was just for starters. Buddy had demonstrated a kind of furious invention when it came to destroying Cuntface's car. It had left Moochie feeling both delighted and uneasy. All in all, that car should not have moved under its own power for 6 months, if ever. So this could not be Christine. It was some other 58 Fury. Except it was Christine. He knew it. Moochie stood there on the deserted early morning sidewalk, his numb ears poking out from beneath his long hair, his breath pluming frostily on the air. The car sat at the curb, facing him, engine growling softly. It was impossible to tell who, if anyone, was behind the wheel. It was parked directly beneath one of the streetlights, and the orange globe burned across the glass of the unmarred windshield like a waterproof jack-o'-lantern seen deep down in dark water. Moochie began to be afraid. He slicked his tongue over dry lips and looked around. To his left was JFK Drive, 6 lanes wide and looking like a dry riverbed at this empty hour of the morning. To his right was a photography shop, orange letters outlined in red spelling Kodak across its window. He looked back at the car. It just sat there, idling. He opened his mouth to speak and produced no sound. He tried again and got a croak. "Hey, Cunningham!" The car sat, seemed to brood, exhaust curled up. The engine rumbled, idling fat on high-test gas. "That you, Cunningham?" He took one more step. A cleat scraped on cement. His heart was thudding in his neck. He looked around at the street again. Surely another car would come. JFK Drive couldn't be totally deserted, even at 1:25 in the morning, could it? But there were no cars. Only the flat orange glare of the streetlights. Moochie cleared his throat. "You ain't mad, are you?" Christine's duel suddenly came on, pinning him in harsh, white light. The Fury ripped toward him, peeling out, the tires screaming black slashes of rubber into the pavement. It came with such sudden power that the rear end seemed to squat like the haunches of a dog preparing to spring, a dog or a she-wolf. The onside wheels jumped up on the pavement and it ran at Moochie that way, offside wheels down, onside wheels up over the curb, canted at an angle. The undercarriage scraped and shrieked and shot off a swirling flicker of sparks. Moochie screamed and tried to sidestep. The edge of Christine's bumper barely flicked his left calf and took a chunk of meat. Warm wetness coursed down his leg and puddled in his shoe. The warmth of his own blood made him realize in a confused way just how cold the night was. He thudded hip first into the doorway of the photo shop, barely missing the plate glass window. A foot to the left and he would have crashed right through, landing in a litter of Nikons and Polaroid One steps. He could hear the car's engine suddenly revving up, that horrible, unearthly shrieking of the undercarriage on the cement again. Moochie turned around, panting harshly. Christine was reversing back up the gutter, and as it passed him, he saw. He saw. There was no one behind the wheel. Panic began to pound in his head. Moochie took to his heels. He ran out into JFK Drive, sprinting for the far side. There was an alley over there between a market and a dry cleaning place, too narrow for the car. If he could get in there... Change jingled madly in his pants pockets and in the 5 or 6 pockets of his army surplus duffel coat. Quarters, nickels, dimes, a jingling silver carillon. He pumped his knees almost to his chin. His cleated engineer boots drummed the pavement. His shadow chased him. The car somewhere behind him revved again, fell off, revved again, fell off. and then the motor began to shriek. The tires wailed, and Christine shot at Moochie Welch's back, crossing the lanes of JFK Drive at right angles. Moochie screamed and could not hear himself scream, because the car was still peeling rubber. The car was still shrieking like an insanely angry, murderous woman, and that shriek filled the world. His shadow was no longer chasing him. It was leading him and getting longer. In the window of the dry-cleaning shop, he saw great yellow eyes blossom. It wasn't even close. At the very last moment, Moochie tried to jig left, but Christine jigged with him, as if she had read his final desperate thought. The Plymouth hit him squarely, still accelerating, breaking Moochie Welch's back and knocking him spang out of his engineer's boots. He was thrown 40 feet into the brick siding of the little market, again narrowly missing a plunge through a plate glass window. The force of his strike was hard enough to cause him to rebound into the street again, leaving a splash of blood on the brick like an ink blot. A picture of it would appear the next day on the front page of the Libertyville Keystone. Christine reversed, screeched to a skidding, sliding stop, and roared forward again. Moochie lay near the curbing, trying to get up. He couldn't get up. Nothing seemed to work. All the signals were scrambled. Bright, white light washed over him. "No," he whispered through a mouthful of broken teeth. The car roared forward and over him. Change flew everywhere. Moochie was pulled and rolled, first one way and then the other, as Christine reversed into the street again. She stood there, engine revving and falling off to a rich idle, then revving again. She stood there, as if thinking. Then she came at him again. She hit him, jumped the curb, skidded around, and then reversed again, thumping back down. She screamed forward and back. And forward. Her headlights glared, her exhaust pipes jetted hot, blue smoke. The thing in the street no longer looked like a human being. It looked like a scattered bundle of rags. The car reversed a final time, skidded around in a half circle, and accelerated, roaring over the bleeding bundle in the street again, and going down the drive, the blast of its engine still winding up to full rev, racketing off the walls of the sleeping buildings. But not entirely sleeping now. Lights were beginning to flick on. People who lived over their stores were going to their windows to see what all the racket had been about, and if there had been an accident. One of Christine's headlights had been shattered. Another flickered unsteadily off and on, bleared with a thin wash of Moochie's blood. The grill had been bent inward, and the dents in it approximated the shape and size of Moochie's torso, with all the gruesome perfection of a death mask. Blood was splashed across the hood in fans that spread out as wind speed increased. The exhaust had taken on a heavy, blatting sound. One of Christine's two mufflers had been destroyed. Inside, on the instrument panel, the odometer continued to run backward, as if Christine were somehow slipping back into time, leaving not only the scene of the hit and run behind, but the actual fact of the hit and run. The muffler was the first thing. Suddenly that heavy blatting sound diminished and smoothed out. The fans of blood on the hood began to run toward the front of the car again, in spite of the wind, as if a movie film had been reversed. The flickering headlight suddenly shone steadily, and a tenth of a mile later, the deadlight became a headlight again. With an unimportant tinkling sound, no more than the sound of a small boy's boot breaking the thin scum of ice on a mud puddle, the glass reassembled itself from nowhere. There was a hollow punk, punk, punk sound from the front end, the sound of denting metal, the sound you sometimes get when you squeeze a beer can. But instead of denting, Christine's grill was popping back out. A body shop veteran with 50 years' experience in putting fender benders right could not have done it more neatly. Christine turned onto Hampton Street even before the first of those awakened by the screaming of her tires had reached Moochie's remains. The blood was gone. It had reached the front of the hood and disappeared. The scratches were gone. As she rolled quietly toward the garage door with its honk for entry sign, there was one final punk as the last dimple, this one in the left front bumper, the spot where Christine had struck Moochie's calf, popped back out. Christine looked like new. The car stopped in front of the large garage door in the middle of the darkened, silent building. There was a small plastic box clipped to the driver's side sun visor. This was a little doodad Will Darnell had given Arnie when Arnie began to run cigarettes and booze over into New York State for him. It was, perhaps, Darnell's version of a gold key to the crapper. In the still air, the door opener hummed briefly, and the garage door rattled obediently up. Another circuit was made by the rising door, and a few interior lights came on, burning weakly. The headlight knob on the dashboard suddenly went in, and Christine's duals went out. She rolled inside and whispered across the oil-stained concrete to stall 20. Behind her, the overhead door, which had been set on a 30-second timer, rolled back down. The light circuit was broken, and the garage was dark again. In Christine's ignition switch, the keys dangling down suddenly turned to the left. The engine died. The leather patch with the initials RDL branded into it swung back and forth in decreasing arcs and was finally still. Christine sat in the dark, and the only sound in Darnell's do-it-yourself garage was the slow tick of her cooling engine. Chapter 31. The Day After. Arnie Cunningham did not go to school the next day. He said he thought he might be coming down with the flu, but that evening he told his parents that he felt enough improved to go down to Darnell's and do some work on Christine. Regina protested. Although she did not come right out and say so, she thought Arnie looked like death warmed over. His face was now entirely free of acne and blemishes, but there was a trade-off. It was much too pale, and there were dark circles under his eyes, as if he hadn't been sleeping. In addition, he was still limping. She wondered uneasily if her son could be using some sort of drug, if perhaps he had hurt his back worse than he had let on, and had started taking pills so he could go on working on the goddamn car. Then she dismissed the thought. Obsessed as he might be with the car, Arnie would not be that stupid. "I'm really fine, Mom," he said. "You don't look fine, and you hardly touched your supper."
"I'll get some chow later on."
"How's your back? You're not lifting a lot of heavy stuff down there, are you?"
"No, Mom."
This was a lie, and his back had hurt terribly all day long. This was the worst it had been since the original injury at Philly Plains.
"Oh, is that where it started?"
his mind whispered.
"Oh, really? Are you sure?"
He had taken the brace off for a while, and his back had throbbed fit to kill him. He had put it on again after only 15 minutes, cinching it tighter than ever. Now his back really was a little better, and he knew why. He was going to her. That was why. Regina looked at him, worried and at a loss. For the first time in her life, she simply did not know how to proceed. Arnie was beyond her control now. Knowing it brought on a horrible feeling of despair that sometimes crept up on her and filled her brain with an awful, empty, rotten coldness. At these times, a depression so total she could barely credit it would steal through her, making her wonder exactly what it was she had lived her life for. So her son could fall in love with a girl and a car all in the same terrible fall? Was that it? So she could see exactly how hateful to him she had become when she looked in his gray eyes. Was that it? And it really didn't have anything to do with the girl at all, did it? No. In her mind, it always came back to the car. Her rest had become broken and uneasy, and for the first time since her miscarriage nearly 20 years before, she had found herself considering making an appointment with Dr. Masha to see if he would give her some pill for the stress and the depression and the attendant insomnia. She thought about Arnie on her long sleepless nights, and about mistakes that could never be rectified. She thought about how time had a way of swinging the balance of power on its axis, and how old age had a way of sometimes looking through a dressing table mirror like the hand of a corpse poking through eroded earth. "Will you be back early?" she asked, knowing this was the last breastwork of the truly powerless parent, hating it, unable now to change it.
Sure, he said. But she didn't much trust the way he said it.
Arnie, I wish you'd stay home. You really don't look good at all.
I'll be fine, he said. Gotta be. I have to run some auto parts over to Jamesburg for Will tomorrow.
Not if you're sick, she said. That's nearly 150 miles.
Don't worry.
He kissed her cheek, the passionless kiss on the cheek of cocktail party acquaintances. He was opening the kitchen door to go out when Regina asked,
Did you know the boy who was run down last night on Kennedy Drive?
He turned back to look at her, his face expressionless.
What?
The paper said he went to Libertyville.
Oh, the hit and run. That's what you're talking about.
Yes?
I had a class with him when I was a freshman, Arnie said. I think. No, I really didn't know him, Mom.
Oh, she nodded, pleased. That's good. The paper said there were residues of drugs in his system. You'd never take drugs, would you, Arnie?
Arnie smiled gently at her pallid, watchful face.
No, Mom, he said.
And if your back started to hurt you, I mean, if it really started to hurt you, you'd go see Dr. Masha about it, wouldn't you? You wouldn't buy anything from a drug pusher, would you?
No, Mom,
he repeated, and went out. There had been more snow. Another thaw had melted most of it, but this time it had not disappeared completely. It had only withdrawn into the shadows, where it formed a white rime under hedges, the bases of trees, the overhangs of the garage. But in spite of the snow around the edges, or maybe because of it, their lawn looked oddly green as Arnie stepped out into the twilight, and his father looked like a strange refugee from summer as he raked the last of the autumn leaves. Arnie raised his hand briefly to his father and made as if to go past without speaking. Michael called him over. Arnie went reluctantly. He didn't want to be late for his bus. His father had also aged in the storms that had blown up over Christine, although other things had undoubtedly played a part. He had made a bid for the chairmanship of the history department at Horlicks late in the summer, and had been rebuffed quite soundly. And during his annual October checkup, the doctor had pointed out an incipient phlebitis problem. Phlebitis, which had nearly killed Nixon. Phlebitis, an old folks' problem. As that late fall moved toward another gray western Pennsylvania winter, Michael Cunningham looked gloomier than ever.
Hi, Dad. Listen, I've got to hurry if I'm going to catch...
Michael looked up from the little pile of frozen brown leaves he had managed to get together. The sunset caught the planes of his face and appeared to make them bleed. Arnie stepped back involuntarily, a little shocked. His father's face was haggard.
Arnold? He said, "Where were you last night?"
"What?"
Arnie gaped, then closed his mouth slowly.
"Why, here. Here, Dad. You know that."
"All night?"
"Of course. I went to bed at 10 o'clock. I was bushed. Why?"
"Because I had a call from the police today," Michael said, "about that boy who was run over on JFK Drive last night."
"Moochie Welch," Arnie said.
He looked at his father with calm eyes that were deeply circled and socketed for all their calmness. If the son had been shocked by the father's appearance, the father was also dully shocked by his son's. To Michael, the boy's eye sockets looked nearly like a skull's vacant orbs in the failing light.
"The last name was Welch, yes."
"They would be in touch, I suppose. Mom doesn't know that... he might have been one of the guys that trashed Christine?"
"Not from me."
"I didn't tell her either. I'd be glad if she didn't find that out," Arnie said.
"She may find it out eventually," Michael said. "In fact, she almost certainly will. She's an extremely intelligent woman, in case you've never noticed. But she won't find it out from me."
Arnie nodded, then smiled humorlessly.
"Where were you last night?"
"Your trust is touching, Dad."
Michael flushed, but his eyes didn't drop. Maybe if you'd been standing outside yourself these last couple of months, he said, you'd understand why I asked.
What the hell does that mean?
You know damn well. It hardly even bears discussing anymore. We just go around and around the same old mulberry bush. Your entire life is jittering apart, and you stand there and ask me what I'm talking about. Arnie laughed. It was a hard, contemptuous sound. Michael seemed to shrivel a little before it.
Mom asked me if I was on drugs. Maybe you want to check that one out, too?
Arnie made as if to push up the sleeves of his warm-up jacket.
Want to check for needle tracks?
I don't need to ask if you're on drugs, Michael said. You're only on one I know of, and that's enough. It's that goddamn car. Arnie turned as if to go, and Michael pulled him back.
Get your hand off my arm!
Michael dropped his hand. I wanted you to be aware, he said. I no more think you'd kill someone than I think you could walk across the Simmons swimming pool. But the police are going to question you, Arnie, and people can look surprised when the police turn up suddenly. To them, surprise can look like guilt.
All of this because some drunk ran over that shitter Welch.
It wasn't like that, Michael said. I got that much out of this fellow Junkins who called me up on the phone. Whoever killed the Welch boy ran him down, and then backed over him, and ran over him again, and backed up again, and...
Stop it!
Arnie said. He suddenly looked sick and frightened, and Michael had much the same feeling Dennis had had on Thanksgiving evening, that in his tired unhappiness, the real Arnie was suddenly close to the surface, perhaps reachable.
It was incredibly brutal,
Michael said. That's what Junkins said. You see, it doesn't look like an accident at all. It looks like murder.
Murder?
Arnie said, dazed.
No, I never...
What? Michael asked sharply. He grabbed Arnie's jacket again. What did you say? Arnie looked at his father. His face was mask-like again.
I never thought it could be that, he said. That's all I was gonna say.
I just wanted you to know, he said. They'll be looking for someone with a motive, no matter how thin. They know what happened to your car, and that the Welch boy might have been involved, or that you might think he was involved. Junkins may be around to talk to you.
I don't have anything to hide.
No, of course not, Michael said. You'll miss your bus.
Yeah,
Arnie said.
Gotta go.
But he stayed a moment longer, looking at his father. Michael suddenly found himself thinking of Arnie's 9th birthday. He and his son had gone to the little zoo in Philly Plains, had eaten lunch out, and had finished the day by playing 18 holes at the indoor miniature golf course on Outer Basin Drive. That place had burned down in 1975. Regina had not been able to come. She had been flat on her back with bronchitis. The two of them had had a fine time. For Michael, that had been his son's best birthday, the one that symbolized for him, above all others, his son's sweet and uneventful American boyhood. They had gone to the zoo and come back, and nothing much had happened, except that they had had a great time, Michael and his son, who had been, and who still was, so dear to him. He wet his lips and said, "Sell her, Arnie. Why don't you? When she's completely restored, sell her away. You could get a lot of money, a couple, 3,000 maybe." Again, that frightened, tired look seemed to sweep over Arnie's face, but Michael couldn't tell for sure. The sunset had faded to a bitter orange line on the western horizon, and the little yard was dark. Then the look, if it had been there at all, went away.
"No, I couldn't do that, Dad," Arnie said gently, as if speaking to a child. "I couldn't do that now. I've put too much into her. Way too much."
And then he was gone, cutting across the yard to the sidewalk, joining the other shadows, and there was only the sound of his footfalls coming back, soon lost. "Put too much into her? Have you? Exactly what, Arnie? What have you put into her?" Michael looked down at the leaves, then around at his yard. Beneath the hedge and under the overhang of the garage, cold snow glimmered in the coming dark, livid and stubbornly waiting for reinforcements. Waiting for winter. Chapter 32. Regina and Michael. Regina was tired. She tired more easily these days, it seemed, and they went to bed together around 9, long before Arnie came in. They made love that was dutiful and joyless. Lately, they made love a lot. It was almost always dutiful and joyless, and Michael had begun having the unpleasant feeling that his wife was using his penis as a sleeping pill. And as they lay in their twin beds after, Michael asked casually, "How did you sleep last night?"
"Quite well," Regina said candidly, and Michael knew she was lying.
"Good." "I came up around 11 and Arnie seemed restless," Michael said, still keeping his voice casual. He was deeply uneasy now. There had been something in Arnie's face tonight, something he hadn't been able to read because of the damned shadows. It was probably nothing, nothing at all, but it glowed in his mind like a baleful neon sign that simply would not shut off. Had his son looked guilty and scared? Or had it just been the light? Unless he could resolve that, sleep would be a long time coming tonight, and it might not come at all.
"I got up around 1, Regina said, then hurried to add, "just to use the bathroom. I checked in on him."
She laughed a little wistfully.
"Old habits die hard, don't they?"
"Yes," Michael said. "I guess they do."
"He was sleeping deeply then. I wish I could get him to wear pajamas in cold weather."
"He was in his skivvies?"
"Yes."
He settled back, immeasurably relieved and more than a little ashamed of himself as well. But it was better to know, for sure. It was all very well for him to tell Arnie that he knew the boy could no more commit a murder than he could walk on water, but the mind, that perverse monkey, the mind can conceive of anything and seems to take a perverse delight in doing so. Just maybe, Michael thought, lacing his hands behind his head and looking up at the dark ceiling, just maybe that's the peculiar damnation of the living. In the mind, a wife can rot, laughing with a best friend. A best friend can cast plots against you and plan backstabbings. A son can commit murder by auto. Better to be ashamed and put the monkey to sleep. Arnie had been here at 1 o'clock. It was unlikely Regina was mistaken about the time because of the digital clock radio on their bureau. It told the time in numbers that were big and blue and unmistakable. His son had been here at 1 o'clock, and the Welch boy had been run down 3 miles away 25 minutes later. Impossible to believe that Arnie could have dressed, gone out without Regina, who had surely been lying wakeful hearing him, gone down to Darnell's, gotten Christine, and driven out to where Moochie Welch had been killed. Physically impossible. Not that he had ever believed it to begin with. The mind monkey was satisfied. Michael rolled over on his right side, slept, and dreamed that he and his 9-year-old son were playing miniature golf on an endless series of small, astroturfed greens where windmills turned and tiny water hazards lay in wait. And he dreamed that they were alone, all alone in the world, because his son's mother had died in childbirth. Very sad. People still remarked on how inconsolable Michael had been. But when they went home, he and his son, the house would be theirs, alone. They would eat spaghetti right from the pot like a couple of bachelor slobs, and when the dishes were washed, they would sit at a kitchen table hidden beneath spread newspapers and build model cars with harmless, plastic engines. In his sleep, Michael Cunningham smiled. Beside him, in the other bed, Regina did not. She lay awake and waited for the sound of the door that would tell her that her son had come in from the world outside. When she heard the door open and close, when she heard his step on the stairs, then she would be able to sleep. Maybe. Chapter 33. Junkins. Junkins turned up at Darnell's around 8:45 that evening. Arnie had just finished with Christine for the night. He had replaced the radio antenna that Repperton's gang had snapped off with a new one, and for the last 15 minutes or so, he had been sitting behind the wheel, listening to WDIL's Friday Night Cavalcade of Gold. He had meant to do no more than turn the radio on and dial across once, making sure that he had hooked up the antenna plug properly, and that there was no static. But he had run onto WDIL's strong signal and had sat there, looking straight through the windshield, his gray eyes musing and far away, as Bobby Fuller sang, "I Fought the Law," as Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers sang, "Why Do Fools Fall in Love," as Eddie Cochran sang, "Come On, Everybody," and Buddy Holly sang, "Rave On." There were no commercials on WDIL Friday nights, and no DJs. Just the sounds. Gone from the charts, but not from our hearts. Every now and then, a soothing female voice would break in and tell him what he already knew, that he was listening to WDIL Pittsburgh, the sound of blue suede radio. Arnie sat dreaming behind the wheel, the red idiot lights glowing on the dash, tapping his fingers, lightly. The antenna was fine. Yes, he had done a good job. It was like Will said, he had a light touch. Look at Christine. Christine proved it. She had been a hunk of junk sitting on LeBay's lawn, and he had brought her back. Then she had been a hunk of junk sitting in the long-term lot out at the airport, and he had brought her back again. He had what? Replace the antenna. Yes. And he had popped some of the dents, he could remember that, but he hadn't ordered any glass, although it was all replaced. He hadn't ordered any new seat covers, but they were all replaced, too. And he had only looked closely under the hood once before slamming it back down in horror at the damage they had done to Christine's mill. But now the radiator was whole, the engine block clean and glowing, the pistons moving free and clear, and it purred like a cat. But there had been dreams. He had dreamed of LeBay behind the wheel of Christine, LeBay dressed in an army uniform that was spotted and splotched with blue-gray patches of graveyard mold. LeBay's flesh had sloughed and run, white, gleaming bone poked through in places. The sockets where LeBay's eyes had once been were empty and dark, but something was squirming in there, yes, something. And then Christine's headlights had come on, and someone had been pinned there, pinned like a bug on a white square of cardboard. Someone familiar. Moochie Welch? Maybe. But as Christine suddenly rocketed forward, tires screaming, it had seemed to Arnie that the terrified face out there on the street ran like tallow, changing even as the Plymouth bore down on it. Now it was Repperton's face, now Sandy Galton's, now it was Will Darnell's heavy, moon face. Whoever was out there had jumped aside, but LeBay had thrown Christine into reverse, working the shift lever with black, rotting fingers. A wedding ring hung on one, as loose as a hoop thrown over the branch of a dead tree. And then he threw it back into drive as the figure raced for the far side of the street, and as Christine bore down again, the head had turned, throwing a terrified glance backward, and Arnie had seen the face of his mother, the face of Dennis Gilder, Lee's face, all eyes under a floating cloud of dark blonde hair, and finally his own face, the twisted mouth forming the words, "No, no, no." Overriding everything, even the heavy thunder of the exhaust, something underneath had been damaged for sure, was LeBay's rotting, triumphant voice, coming from a decayed larynx, passing lips that were already shriveled away from the teeth and tattooed with a delicate spidering of dark green mold. LeBay's triumphant, shrieking voice. "Here you go, you shitter! See how you like it!" There had been the heavy, mortal thud of Christine's bumper striking flesh, the gleam of a pair of spectacles rising in the night air, turning over and over, and then Arnie had awakened in his room, curled into a trembling ball and clutching his pillow. It had been 1:45 in the morning, and his first feeling had been a great and terrible relief. Relief that he was still alive. He was alive. LeBay was dead. And Christine was safe. The only three things in the world that mattered. "Oh, but Arnie, how did you hurt your back?" Some voice inside, sly and insinuating, asking a question he was afraid to answer. "I heard it at Philly Plains," he had told everyone. one of the junkers started to slip back down the ramp of Will's flatbed, and I pushed it back up. Didn't think about it. I just did it. Strained something really bad. So he had said. And one of the junkers had started to slip, and he had pushed it back up, but that hadn't been how he hurt his back, had it? No. That night, after he and Lee had found Christine smashed to hell in the parking lot, sitting on 4 slash tires, that night at Darnell's, after everyone was gone, he had tuned the radio in Will's office to the oldies on WDIL. Will trusted him now, why not? He was running cigarettes across the state line into New York. He was running fireworks all the way over to Burlington. And twice he had run something wrapped in flat brown paper packages into Wheeling, where a young guy in an old Dodge Challenger traded him another slightly larger brown paper package for it. Arnie thought maybe he was trading cocaine for money, but he didn't want to know for sure. He drove a boat on these trips, Will's private car, a 1966 Imperial as black as midnight in Persia. It was whisper quiet, and the trunk had a false bottom. If you kept to the speed limit, it was no problem. Why should it be? The important thing was that he now had the keys to the garage. He could come in after everyone else was gone, like he had that night. And he had turned on WDIL. And he had hurt his back, somehow. What had he been doing to hurt his back? A strange phrase came to him in answer, floating up from his subconscious. It's just a funny little glitch. Did he really want to know? He didn't. In fact, there were times when he didn't want the car at all. There were times when he felt he would be better off just, well, junking it. Not that he ever would or could. It was just that sometimes, in the sweaty, shaking aftermath of that dream last night, for instance, he felt that if he got rid of it, he would be happier. The radio suddenly spat an almost feline burst of static. "Don't worry," Arnie whispered. He ran his hand slowly over the dashboard, loving the feel of it. Yes, the car frightened him sometimes. And he supposed his father was right. It had changed his life to some degree. But he could no more junk it than he could commit suicide. The static cleared. The Marvelettes were singing, "Please, Mr. Postman." And then a voice said in his ear, "Arnold Cunningham?" He jumped and snapped off the radio. He turned around. A small, dapper little man was leaning in Christine's window. His eyes were a dark brown, and his color was high from the cold outside, Arnie guessed. "Yes?" "Rudolph Junkins, State Police Detective Division?" Junkins stuck his hand in through the open window. Arnie looked at it for a moment. So his father had been right. He grinned his most charming grin, took the hand, shook it firmly, and said, "Don't shoot, copper. I'll throw out my guns." Junkins returned Arnie's grin, but Arnie noticed that the grin did no more than touch his eyes, which were exploring the car in a quick, thorough fashion that Arnie didn't like. Not at all. "Woo! I got the feeling from the local police that the guys who worked over your rolling iron had really tattooed it. It sure doesn't look like it." Arnie shrugged and got out of the car. Friday nights were slow at the garage. Will himself rarely came in, and he wasn't in tonight. Across the way, in stall 10, a fellow named Gabs was putting a new muffler on his old Valiant, and down at the far end of the garage, there was the periodic burr of an air wrench as some fellow put on his snow tires. Otherwise, he and Junkins had the place to themselves. "It wasn't anywhere near as bad as it looked," Arnie said. He thought that this smiling, dapper little man might be extremely clever. As if it was a natural outgrowth of the thought, he rested his hand easily on Christine's roof and immediately felt better. He could cope with this man, clever or not. After all, what was there to worry about? There was no structural damage. "Oh? I understood they punched holes in the body with some sharp instrument," Junkins said, looking closely at Christine's flank. "I'll be damned if I can see the fill. You must be a bodywork genius, Arnie. The way my wife drives, maybe I ought to put you on retainer." He smiled disarmingly, but his eyes went on running back and forth over the car. They would dart momentarily to Arnie's face and then go back to the car again. Arnie liked it less
and less.
I'm good, but not God, Arnie said. You can see the bodywork if you really look for it.
He pointed at a minute ripple in Christine's back deck.
And there, he pointed at another. I was lucky enough to find some original Plymouth body parts up in Ruggles. I replaced the entire back door on this side. You see the way the paint doesn't quite match?
He knocked his knuckles on the door.
Nope, Junkins said. I might be able to tell with a microscope, Arnie, but it looks like a perfect match to me.
He also knocked his knuckles on the door. Arnie frowned.
Hell of a job, Junkins said. He walked slowly around to the front of the car.
Hell of a job, Arnie. You're to be congratulated.
Thanks.
He watched as Junkins, in the guise of the sincere admirer, used his sharp brown eyes to look for suspicious dents, flaked paint, maybe a spot of blood or a snarl of matted hair, looking for signs of Moochie Welch. Arnie was suddenly sure that was just what the shitter was doing.
What exactly can I do for you, Detective Junkins?
Junkins laughed. Man, that's formal. I can't take that. Make it Rudy, okay?
Sure,
Arnie said, smiling.
What can I do for you, Rudy?
You know, it's funny, Junkins said, squatting to look at the driver's side headlights. He tapped one of them reflectively with his knuckles, and then, with seeming absent-mindedness, ran his forefinger along the headlight's semicircular metal hood. His overcoat pooled on the oil-stained cement floor for a moment. Then he stood up.
We get reports on anything of this nature. The trashing of your car, I mean.
Oh, hey, they didn't really
trash it, Arnie said. He was beginning to feel as if he was on a tightrope, and he touched Christine again. Her solidity, her reality, once more seemed to comfort him.
They tried, you know, but they didn't do a very good job.
Okay, I guess I'm not up on the current terminology, Junkins laughed. Anyway, when it came to my attention, what do you think I said? Where's the photographs?
That's what I said. I thought it was an oversight, you know. So I called the Libertyville PD, and they said there were no photographs.
No, Arnie said. A kid my age can't get anything but liability insurance, you know that. Even the liability comes with a $700 deductible. If I had damage insurance, I would have taken plenty of pictures, but since I didn't, why would I? I sure wouldn't want them for my scrapbook.
No, I guess not, Junkins said, and walked idly around to the rear of the car, eyes searching for broken glass, for scrapes, for guilt.
But you know what else I thought was funny? You didn't even report the crime.
He raised his dark, questioning eyes to Arnie's, looked at him closely, and then smiled a phony, bewildered little smile.
Didn't even report it.
Huh, I said. Son of a bitch. Who reported it?
Guy's father, they tell me.
Junkin shook his head.
I don't get that, Arnie.
I don't mind telling you. A guy works his ass off for storing an old car until it's worth $2,000, maybe $5,000. And some guys come along and beat the hell out of it.
I told you.
Rudy Junkins raised his hand and smiled disarmingly. For one weird second, Arnie thought he was going to say peace, as Dennis sometimes did when things got heavy.
Damaged it. Sorry.
Sure, Arnie said. Anyhow, according to what your girlfriend said, one of the perpetrators, well, defecated on the dashboard.
I would have thought you would have been mad as hell.
I would have thought you would have reported it. Now the smile faded altogether, and Junkins looked at Arnie soberly, even sternly. Arnie's cool gray eyes met Junkins's brown ones.
Shit wipes off, he said finally. You want to know something, Mr. Rudy? You want me to tell you something?
Sure, son.
When I was 1½, I got hold of a fork and marked up an antique bureau that my mother had saved up for over a period of maybe 5 years. Saved up her pin money, that's what she said. I guess I racked the hell out of it in a very short time. Of course, I don't remember it, but she says she sat right down and bawled.
Arnie smiled a little.
Up until this year, I couldn't feature my mother doing that. Now? I think I can. Maybe I'm growing up a little. What do you think?
Junkins lit a cigarette. Am I missing the point, Arnie? Because I don't see it yet.
She said that she would rather have had me in diapers until I was 3 than have had me do that. Because, she said, shit wipes off.
Arnie smiled.
You flush it away, and it's gone.
The way Moochie Welch is gone, Junkins asked.
I know nothing about that.
No?
No.
Scat's honor, Junkins asked. The question was humorous, but the eyes were not. They probed at Arnie, looking for the smallest break, a crucial flicker. Down the aisle, the fellow who had been putting on his winter snows dropped a tool on the concrete. It clanged musically, and the fellow chanted almost chorally, "Aw, shit on you, you whore!" Junkins and Arnie both glanced that way briefly, and the moment was broken.
"Sure, Scout's honor," Arnie said. "Look, I suppose you have to do this. It's your job."
"Sure it's my job," Junkins agreed softly. "The boy was run over 3 times each way. He was meat. They scraped him up with a shovel."
"Come on," Arnie said sickly. His stomach did a lazy barrel roll.
"Why? Isn't that what you're supposed to do with shit? Scrape it up with a shovel?"
"I had nothing to do with it,"
Arnie cried, and the man across the way, who had been tinkering with his muffler, looked up, startled. Arnie lowered his voice.
"I'm sorry. I just wish you'd leave me alone. You know damn well I didn't have anything to do with it. You just went over the whole car. If Christine had hit that Welch kid that many times and that hard, it would be all busted up. I know that much just from watching TV. And when I was taking Auto Shop 1 2 years ago, Mr. Smolnack said that the 2 best ways he knew to totally destroy a car's front end was to either hit a deer or a person. He was joking a little, but he wasn't kidding, if you know what I mean."
Arnie swallowed and heard a click in his throat, which was very dry. "Sure," Junkins said. "Your car looks all right. But you don't, kid. You look like a sleepwalker. You look absolutely fucked over. Pardon my French." He flicked his cigarette away. "You know something, Arnie?"
"What?"
"I think you're lying faster than a horse can trot." He slapped Christine's hood. "Or maybe I should say, faster than a Plymouth can run." Arnie looked at him, his hand on the outside mirror on the passenger side. He said nothing. "I don't think you're lying about killing the Welch boy, but I think you're lying about what they did to your car. Your girl said they mashed the crap out of it, and she's a hell of a lot more convincing than you are. She cried while she told me. She said there was broken glass everywhere. Where'd you buy the replacement glass, by the way?"
"McConnell's," Arnie said promptly. "In the burg."
"Still got the receipt?"
"Tossed it out."
"But they'll remember you, big order like that."
"They might," Arnie said, "but I wouldn't count on it, Rudy. They're the biggest auto glass specialist west of New York and east of Chicago. That covers a lot of ground. They do yay business, and a lot of it's old cars."
"Still, they'll have the paperwork."
"I paid cash."
"But your name will be on the invoice."
"Nope,"
Arnie said, and smiled a wintry smile.
"Darnell's do-it-yourself garage. That way I got a 10% discount."
"You got it all covered, don't you?"
"Lieutenant Junkins, you're lying about the glass, too. Although I'll be goddamned if I know why." "You'd think Christ was lying on Calvary. That's what I think,"
Arnie said angrily.
"Since when is it a crime to buy replacement glass if someone busts up your windows, or pay cash, or get a discount?"
"Since never," Junkins said.
"Then leave me be."
"More important, I think you're lying about not knowing anything about what happened to the Welch boy. You know something. I want to know what."
"I don't know anything," Arnie said.
"What about..."
"I don't have anything more to say to you," Arnie said. "I'm sorry."
"All right," Junkins said. giving up so quickly that Arnie was immediately suspicious. He rummaged around in the sport coat he was wearing under his topcoat and took out his wallet. Arnie saw that Junkins was carrying a gun in a shoulder holster and suspected Junkins had wanted him to see it. He produced a card and gave it to Arnie. "I can be reached at either of those numbers. If you want to talk about anything. Anything at all." Arnie put the card in his breast pocket. Junkins took one more leisurely stroll around Christine. "Hell of a restoration job," he repeated. He looked squarely at Arnie. "Why didn't you report it?" Arnie let out a low, shuddering sigh. "Because I thought that would be the end," he said. "I thought they'd let off." "Yeah," Junkins said. "I thought that might be it. Good night, son."
"Good night."
Junkins started away, turned, came back. "Think it over," he said. "You really do look like hell. You know what I mean? You have a nice girl there. She's worried about you. And she feels bad about what happened to your car. Your dad's worried about you, too. I could get that even over the phone. Think it over. And then give me a call, son. You'll sleep better." Arnie felt something trembling behind his lips, something small and tearful, something that hurt. Junkins' brown eyes were kind. He opened his mouth. God alone knew what might have spilled out. And then a monstrous jab of pain walloped him in the back, making him straighten suddenly. It also had the effect of a slap on a hysteric. He felt calmer, clear-headed again.
"Good night," he repeated. "Good night, Rudy."
Junkins looked at him a moment longer, troubled, and then left. Arnie began to shake all over. The trembling started in his hands and spread up his forearms to his elbows, and then it was suddenly everywhere. He grabbed blindly for the door handle, found it at last, and slipped into Christine, into the comforting smells of car and fresh upholstery. He turned the key to ACC, the idiot lights glowed, and he felt for the radio dial. As he did so, his eyes fell on the swinging leather tab with RDL branded into it, and his dream recurred. With sudden, terrible force. The rotting corpse sitting where he was sitting now, the empty eye sockets staring out through the windshield, the finger bones gripping the wheel, the empty grin of the skull's teeth as Christine bore down on Moochie Welch, while the radio, tuned to WDIL, played Last Kiss by J. Frank Wilson and the Cavaliers. He suddenly felt sick. Puking sick, nausea fluttered sickeningly in his stomach and in the back of his throat. Arnie scrambled out of the car and ran for the head, his footfalls hammering crazily in his ears. He just made it. Everything came up. He vomited again and again until there was nothing left but sour spit. Lights danced in front of his eyes, his ears rang, and the muscles in his gut throbbed tiredly. He looked at his pale, harried face in the spotty mirror. At the dark circles under his eyes, and the lank spill of hair across his forehead. Junkins was right. He looked like hell. But his pimples were all gone. He laughed crazily. He wouldn't give Christine up, no matter what. That was the one thing he wouldn't do. And suddenly he had to do it again, only there was nothing left to come up, only ripping, clenching dry heaves and that electric taste of spit in his mouth again. He had to talk to Lee. Quite suddenly, he had to talk to Lee. He let himself into Will's office, where the only sound was the thump of the time clock bolted on the wall, turning up fresh minutes. He dialed the Cabot's number from memory, but miscued twice because his fingers were trembling so badly. Lee herself answered, her voice sounding sleepy.
"Arnie? I have to talk to you, Lee. I have to see you. Arnie, it's almost 10 o'clock. I just got out of the shower and into bed. I was almost asleep.
Please,"
he said, and shut his eyes.
"Tomorrow," she said. "It can't be tonight. My folks wouldn't let me out so late.
It's only 10, and it's Friday."
They really don't want me to see so much of you, Arnie. They liked you at first, and my dad still does, but they both think you've gotten a little spooky.
There was a long, long pause at Lee's end.
I think you have, too, she said, finally.
Does that mean you don't want to see me anymore? He asked, dully.
His stomach hurt. His back hurt. Everything hurt.
No, now the faintest reproach crept into her voice.
I was kind of getting the idea that you didn't want to see me. Not at school, and nights you're always down there at the garage, working on your car.
That's all done, he said,
and then, with a monstrous effort,
it's the car I want to... Ah, God damn it!
He grabbed at his back, where there had been another huge bolt of pain, and got only a handful of back brace.
Arnie? She was alarmed. Are you all right?
Yeah. I had a twinge in my back.
What were you going to say?
Tomorrow, he said, we'll drive over to Baskin-Robbins and have an ice cream and maybe do some Christmas shopping and have some supper and I'll have you home by 7 and I won't be weird. I promise.
She laughed a little, and Arnie felt a great sweeping relief. It was like balm.
You dummy.
Does that mean okay?
Yes, it means okay.
Lee paused, and then said softly,
I said my parents didn't want me to see so much of you. I didn't say I wanted that.
Thanks,
he said, struggling to keep his voice steady.
Thanks for that.
What do you want to talk to me about?
Christine, I want to talk to you about her, and about my dreams, and about why I look like hell, and why I always want to listen to WDIL now, and about what I did that night after everyone was gone, the night I hurt my back. Oh, Lee, I want... Another slash of pain up his back like cat's claws.
I think we just talked about it, he said.
Oh.
A slight, warm pause.
Good.
Lee? There'll be more time now. I promise. All the time you want.
And thought, because now, with Dennis in the hospital, you're all that's left. All that's left between me... me and...
That's good, Lee said.
I love you.
Goodbye, Arnie.
Say it back, he wanted to shout suddenly. Say it back, I need you to say it back. But there was only the click of the phone in his ear. He sat behind Will's desk for a long time, head lowered, getting hold of himself. She didn't need to say it back every time he said it to her, did she? He didn't need reassurance that badly, did he? Did he? Arnie got up and went to the door. She was coming out with him tomorrow. That was the important thing. They would do the Christmas shopping they had been planning on the day those shitters trashed Christine. They would walk and talk. They would have a good time. She would say she loved him.
She'll say it,
he whispered, standing in the doorway. But halfway down the left-hand side of the garage, Christine sat like a mute and stupid denial, her grill poking forward as if hunting something. And the voice whispered out of his lower consciousness, the dark, questioning voice. How did you hurt your back? How did you hurt your back? How did you hurt your back, Arnie? It was a question he shrank from. He was afraid of the answer. Chapter 34. Lee and Christine. It was a gray day, threatening snow. But Arnie was right on both counts. They had a good time, and he wasn't weird. Mrs. Cabot had been at home when Arnie got there, and her initial reception was cool. But it was a long time, perhaps 20 minutes, before Lee came downstairs, wearing a caramel-colored sweater that clung lovingly to her breasts, and a new pair of cranberry-colored slacks that clung lovingly to her hips. This inexplicable lateness in a girl who was almost always perfectly on time might have been on purpose. Arnie asked her later, and Lee denied it with an innocence that was perhaps just a little too wide-eyed. But in any case, it served its purpose. Arnie could be charming when he had to be, and he went to work on Mrs. Cabot with a will. Before Lee finally came bouncing downstairs, twisting her hair into a ponytail, Mrs. Cabot had thawed. She had gotten Arnie a Pepsi Cola and was listening raptly as he regaled her with tales of the chess club. "It's the only civilized extracurricular activity I've ever heard of," she told Lee, and smiled approvingly at Arnie. "Boring," Lee trumpeted. She put an arm around Arnie's waist and smacked him loudly on the cheek. "Lee Cabot! Sorry, Mums, but he looks cute in lipstick, doesn't he? Wait a minute, Arnie, I've got a Kleenex. Don't claw at it." She dug in her purse for a tissue. Arnie looked at Mrs. Cabot and rolled his eyes. Natalie Cabot put a hand to her mouth and giggled. The rapprochement between her and Arnie was complete. Arnie and Lee went to Baskin-Robbins, where an initial awkwardness left over from the phone conversation of the night before finally melted away. Arnie had had a vague fear that Christine would not run well, or that Lee would find something nasty to say about her. She had never liked riding in his car. Both were needless worries. Christine ran like a fine Swiss watch, and the only things Lee had to say about her rang of pleasure and amazement. "I never would have believed it," she said, as they drove out of the ice cream parlor's small parking lot and joined the flow of traffic headed toward the Monroeville Mall. "You must have worked like a dog."
"It wasn't as bad as it probably looked to you," Arnie said. "Mind some music?"
"No, of course not."
Arnie turned on the radio. The Silhouettes were kip-kipping and boom-booming through Get a Job. Lee made a face.
"D.I.L., yuck. Can I change it?"
"Be my guest."
Lee switched it to a Pittsburgh rock station and got Billy Joel. "You may be right," Billy admitted cheerfully. "I may be crazy." This was followed by Billy telling his girl Virginia the Catholic girl started much too late. It was the block party weekend. Now, Arnie thought, now she'll start to hitch, back off, something. But Christine only went rolling along. The mall was thronged with hectic but mostly good-natured shoppers. The last frantic and sometimes ugly Christmas rush was better than 2 weeks off. The Yuletide spirit was still new enough to be novel, and it was possible to look at the tinsel strung through the wide mall hallways without feeling sour and Ebenezer Scroogey. The steady ringing of the Salvation Army Santa's bells had not yet become a guilty annoyance. They still chanted good tidings and goodwill, rather than the monotonous, metallic chant of "the poor have no Christmas, the poor have no Christmas, the poor have no Christmas," that Arnie always seemed to hear as the day grew closer and both the shop girls and the Salvation Army Santas grew more harried and hollow-eyed. They held hands until the parcels grew too many for that, and then Arnie complained good-naturedly about how she was turning him into her beast of burden. As they were going down to the lower level and B. Dalton, where Arnie wanted to look for a book on toy making for Dennis Gilder's old man, Lee noticed that it had begun to snow. They stood for a moment at the window of the glassed-in stairwell, looking out like children. Arnie took her hand, and Lee looked at him, smiling. He could smell her skin, clean and a bit soapy. He could smell the fragrance of her hair. He moved his head forward a bit. She moved hers a bit toward him. They kissed. Lightly, and she squeezed his hand. Later, after the bookstore, they stood above the rink in the center of the mall, watching the skaters as they dipped and pirouetted and swooped to the sound of Christmas carols. It was a very good day, right up until the moment that Lee Cabot almost died. She almost surely would have died, if not for the hitchhiker. They had been on their way back then, and an early December twilight had long since turned to snowy dark. Christine, sure-footed as usual, purred easily through the 4 inches of fresh light powder. Arnie had made a reservation for an early dinner at the British Lion Steakhouse, Libertyville's only really good restaurant. But the time had gotten away from them, and they had agreed on a quick-to-go meal from the McDonald's on JFK Drive. Lee had promised her mother she would be in by 8:30 because the Cabots were having friends in, and it had been 7:45 when they left the mall.
"Just as well," Arnie said. "I'm damn near broke anyway."
The headlights picked out the hitchhiker standing at the intersection of Route 17 and JFK Drive, still 5 miles outside of Libertyville. His black hair was shoulder-length, speckled with snow, and there was a duffel bag between his feet. As they approached him, the hitchhiker held up a sign painted with day-glow letters. It read, Libertyville, PA. As they drew closer, he flipped it over. The other side read, Non-Psycho College Student. Lee burst out laughing. Let's give him a ride, Arnie. Arnie said, When they go out of their way to advertise their non-psychotic status, that's when you gotta look out. But okay. He pulled over. That evening, he would have tried to catch the moon in a bushel basket if Lee had asked him to give it a shot. Christine rolled smoothly to the verge of the road, tires barely slipping. But as they stopped, static blared across the radio, which had been playing some hard rock tune, and when the static cleared, there was the Big Bopper, singing Chantilly Lace.
What happened to the block party weekend? Lee asked as the hitchhiker ran toward them.
I don't know, Arnie said. But he knew. It had happened before. Sometimes all that Christine's radio would pick up was WDIL. It didn't matter what buttons you pushed or how much you fooled with the FM converter under the dashboard. It was WDIL or nothing. He suddenly felt that stopping for the hitchhiker had been a mistake. But it was too late for second thoughts now. The fellow had opened one of Christine's rear doors, tossed his duffel bag onto the floor, and slipped in after it. A blast of cold air and a swirl of snow came in with him.
Ah, man, thanks, he sighed. My fingers and toes all took off from Miami Beach about 20 minutes ago. They must have gone somewhere anyway, because I sure can't feel them anymore.
Thank my lady, Arnie said shortly.
Thank you, ma'am, the hitchhiker said, tipping an invisible hat gallantly.
Don't mention it, Lee said, and smiled. Merry Christmas.
Same to you, the hitchhiker said, although you'd never know there was such a thing if you'd been standing out there trying to hook a ride tonight. People just breeze by, and then they're gone. Boom!
He looked around, appreciatively.
Nice car, man. Hell of a nice car.
Thanks, Arnie said.
You restore it yourself?
Yeah. Lee was looking at Arnie, puzzled. His earlier expansive mood had been replaced by a curtness that was not like his usual self at all. On the radio, the Big Bopper finished, and Richie Valens came on, doing La Bamba. The hitchhiker shook his head and laughed.
First a Big Bopper, then Richie Valens. Must be Death Night on the radio. Good old WDIL.
What do you mean? Lee asked. Arnie snapped the radio off.
They died in a plane crash with Buddy Holly.
Oh,
Lee said in a small voice. Perhaps the hitchhiker also sensed the change in Arnie's mood. He fell silent and meditative in the back seat. Outside, the snow began to fall faster and harder. The first good storm of the season had come in. At length, the golden arches twinkled up out of the snow.
"Do you want me to go in, Arnie?"
Lee asked. Arnie had gone nearly as quiet as stone, turning aside her bright attempts at conversation with mere grunts.
"I will," he said, and pulled in. "What do you want?"
"Just a hamburger and French fries, please."
She had intended to go the whole hog, Big Mac, shake, even the cookies, but her appetite seemed to have shrunk away to nothing. Arnie parked. In the yellow light flaring from the squat brick building's undersides, his face looked jaundiced and somehow diseased. He turned around, arm trailing over the seat.
"Can I grab you something?"
"No, thanks," the hitchhiker said. "Folks will be waiting supper. Can't disappoint my mom. She kills a fatted calf every time I come..." The chunk of the door cut off his final word. Arnie had gotten out and was headed briskly across to the inn door, his boots kicking up little puffs of new snow.
"Is he always that cheery?" the hitchhiker asked. "Or does he get taciturn sometimes?"
"He's very sweet," Lee said firmly.
She was suddenly nervous. Arnie had turned off the engine and taken the keys, and she was left alone with this stranger in the back seat. She could see him in the rearview mirror, and suddenly his long black hair, tangled by the wind, his scruff of beard, and his dark eyes made him seem Manson-like and wild.
"Where do you go to school?"
she asked. Her fingers were plucking at her slacks, and she made them stop.
"Pitt,"
the hitchhiker said, and no more. His eyes met hers in the mirror, and Lee dropped hers hastily to her lap.
cranberry red slacks. She had worn them because Arnie had once told her he liked them, probably because they were the tightest pair she owned, even tighter than her Levi's. She suddenly wished she had worn something else, something that could be considered provocative by no stretch of the imagination, a grain sack, maybe. She tried to smile. It was a funny thought, all right, a grain sack. Get it? Ha-ha, ho-ho, what a knee-slapper? But no smile came. There was no way she could keep from admitting it to herself. Arnie had left her alone with this stranger. As punishment? It had been her idea to pick him up. And now she was scared.
"Bad vibes,"
the hitchhiker said suddenly, making her actually catch her breath. His words were flat and final. She could see Arnie through the plate glass window, standing fifth or sixth in line. He wouldn't get up to the counter for a while. She found herself imagining the hitchhiker suddenly clamping his gloved hands around her throat. Of course, she could reach the horn ring, but would the horn sound? She found herself doubting it for no sane reason at all. She found herself thinking she could hit the horn 99 times and it would honk satisfyingly. But if on the 100th she was being strangled by this hitchhiker, on whose behalf she had interceded, the horn wouldn't blow. Because Christine didn't like her. In fact, she believed that Christine hated her guts. It was as simple as that. Crazy, but simple.
Pardon me?
She glanced back in the rearview mirror and was immeasurably relieved to see that the hitchhiker wasn't looking at her at all. He was glancing around the car. He touched the seat cover with his palm, then lightly brushed the roof upholstery with the tips of his fingers.
Bad vibes, he said, and shook his head. This car... I don't know why, but I get bad vibes.
Do you?
She asked, hoping her voice sounded neutral.
Yeah. I got stuck in an elevator once when I was a little kid. Ever since then, I get attacks of claustrophobia. I never had one in a car before, but boy, I got one now. In the worst way. I think you could light a kitchen match on my tongue. That's how dry my mouth is.
He laughed, a short, embarrassed laugh.
If I wasn't already so late, I'd just get out and walk. No offense to you or your guy's car, he added hastily,
and when Lee looked back into the mirror, his eyes did not seem wild at all, only nervous. Apparently he wasn't kidding about the claustrophobia, and he no longer looked like Charlie Manson to her at all. Lee wondered how she could have been so stupid, except she knew how, and why. She knew perfectly well. It was the car. All day long, she had felt perfectly okay riding in Christine, but now her former nervousness and dislike were back. She had merely projected her feelings onto the hitchhiker because, well, because you could be scared and nervous about some guy you just picked up off the road. But it was insane to be scared by a car, an inanimate construct of steel and glass and plastic and chrome. That wasn't just a little eccentric. It was insane.
You don't smell anything, do you?
He asked abruptly.
Smell anything?
A bad smell?
No, not at all.
Her fingers were plucking at the bottom of her sweater now, pulling off wisps of angora. Her heart was knocking unpleasantly in her chest.
It must be part of your claustrophobia, what's-its.
I guess so.
But she could smell it. Under the good new smells of leather and upholstery, there was a faint odor. Something like gone-over eggs, just a whiff, a lingering whiff.
Mind if I crank the window down a little?
If you want,
Lee said, and found it took some effort to keep her voice steady and casual. Suddenly, her mind's eye showed her the picture that had been in the paper yesterday morning, a picture of Moochie Welch, probably culled from the yearbook. The caption beneath read, Peter Welch, victim of fatal hit-and-run incident that police feel may have been murder. The hitchhiker unrolled his window 3 inches, and crisp, cold air came in, driving that smell away. Inside McDee's, Arnie had reached the counter and was giving his order. Looking at him, Lee experienced such an odd swirl of love and fear that she felt nauseated by the mixture. For the second or third time lately, she found herself wishing that she had fixed on Dennis first. Dennis, who seemed so safe and sensible. She turned her thoughts away from that.
"Just tell me if it gets cold on you," the hitchhiker said apologetically. "I'm weird, I know it."
He sighed.
"Sometimes I think I never should have given up drugs, you know?"
Lee smiled.
Arnie came out with a white bag, skidded a little in the snow, and then got behind the wheel.
"Cold like an icebox in here," he grunted.
"Sorry, man," the hitchhiker said from the back and rolled the window up again. Lee waited to see if that smell would come back, but now she could smell nothing but leather, upholstery, and the faint aroma of Arnie's aftershave.
"Here you go, Lee."
He gave her a burger, fries, and a small Coke. He had gotten himself a Big Mac.
"Wanna thank you again for the ride, man," the hitchhiker said. "You can just drop me off at the corner of JFK and Center, if that's cool."
"Fine," Arnie said shortly and pulled out. The snow was coming down even more heavily now, and the wind had begun to whoop. For the first time, Lee felt Christine skid a bit as she felt for a grip on the wide street, which was now almost deserted. They were less than 15 minutes from home. With the smell gone, Lee discovered that her appetite had come back. She wolfed half of her hamburger, drank some Coke, and stifled a burp with the back of her hand. The corner of Center and JFK, marked with a war memorial, came up on the left, and Arnie pulled over, pumping the brakes lightly so Christine wouldn't slide.
"Have a nice weekend," Arnie said.
He sounded more like his usual self now. Maybe all he needed was some food, Lee thought, amused.
"Same goes to both of you," the hitchhiker said. "And have a Merry Christmas."
"You too,"
Lee said. She took another bite of her hamburger, chewed, swallowed, and felt it lodge halfway down her throat. Suddenly, she couldn't breathe. The hitchhiker was getting out. The noise of the door opening was very loud. The sound of the latch clicking sounded like the thud of tumblers falling in a bank vault. The sound of the wind was like a factory whistle.
"This is stupid, I know, but I can't, Arnie, I can't breathe. I'm choking,"
she tried to say, and what came out was a faint, fuzzy sound that she was sure the whine of the wind must have covered. She clawed at her throat, and it felt swollen and throbbing in her hand. She tried to scream, no breath to scream, no breath, "Arnie, I can't," at all, and she could feel it in there, a warm lump of burger and bun. She tried to cough it up, and it wouldn't come. The dashboard lights, bright green, circular, cat, like the eyes of a cat. "Dear God, I can't breathe," watching her. "God, I can't breathe, can't breathe, can't—" Her chest began to pound for air. Again she tried to cough up the lump of half-chewed burger and bun in her throat, but it wouldn't come. Now the sound of the wind was bigger than the world, bigger than any sound she had ever heard before, and Arnie was finally turning away from the hitchhiker to look at her. He was turning in slow motion, his eyes widening almost comically, and even his voice seemed too loud, like thunder, the voice of Zeus speaking to some poor mortal from behind a massy sky stack of thunderclouds.
"Lee, are you... what the hell? She's choking! Oh my God, she's..."
He reached for her in slow motion, and then he drew his hands back, immobilized by panic.
"Oh, help me, for God's sake, do something, I'm dying. Oh, my dear God, I'm choking to death on a McDonald's hamburger. Arnie, why don't you help me?"
And of course, she knew why. He drew back because Christine didn't want her to have any help. This was Christine's way of getting rid of her. Christine's way of getting rid of the other woman, the competition. And now the dashboard instruments really were eyes. Great, round, unemotional eyes watching her choke to death. Eyes she could see only through a growing jitter of black dots. Dots that burst and spread as,
"Mama, oh my dear, this... I'm dying, and she sees me. She's alive, alive, alive. Oh, Mama, my God, Christine is alive!"
Arnie reached for her again. Now she had begun to thrash on the seat, her chest heaving spasmodically as she clawed at her throat. Her eyes were bulging. Her lips had begun to turn blue. Arnie was pounding her ineffectually on the back and yelling something. He grabbed her shoulder, apparently meaning to pull her out of the car, and then he suddenly winced and straightened, his hands going involuntarily to the small of his back. Lee twitched and thrashed. The blockage in her throat felt huge and hot and throbbing. She tried again to cough it up more weakly this time. The lump didn't budge. Now the whistle of the wind was beginning to fade. Everything was beginning to fade. But her need for air didn't seem so awful. Maybe she was dying, but suddenly it didn't seem so bad. Nothing was so bad except for those green eyes staring at her from the instrument panel. They weren't unemotional anymore. Now they were blazing with hate.
and triumph.
Oh, my God, I am heartily sorry for having offended thee. I am for offending. This is my act of...
Arnie had reached across from the driver's side. Now Lee's door was suddenly jerked open and she was spilled sideways into a brutal, cutting cold. The air partially revived her, made her struggle for breath seem important again, but the obstruction wouldn't move. It just wouldn't move. From far away, Arnie's voice thundering sternly, the voice of Zeus. "What are you doing? Get your hands off her!" Arms around her, strong arms, the wind on her face, snow swirling in her eyes.
Oh, my God, hear me, a sinner, this is my act of contrition. I am heartily sorry for having offended. Oh, ow, what are you doing? My ribs hurts. What are you...
And suddenly there were arms around her, crushing, and a pair of hard hands were clasped together in a knot just below her breasts, in the hollow of her solar plexus, and suddenly one thumb popped up, the thumb of a hitchhiker signaling for a ride, only the thumb drove painfully into her breastbone at the same